Hello, I'm Robin Lynn Maven, the CEO, creator, and producer of Vibes Live. We have over 2 million geographical listeners reaching 200 countries with nonstop music 24/7. Just tune in on VibesLive.com. I say the hip hop, you just don't stop it, and just get ready to jam. The Disco Daddy Wide World of Hip Hop Radio Show, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, only on VibesLive.com, with special guests every week. Don't miss it.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here, and welcome to another edition of Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop and R&B. We are blessed today. If you've been following our show, you know that we have been speaking to legendary figures in the world of hip hop, people who go back to the very beginning of this culture before records were even being recorded. We are blessed, truly blessed, to have one of those gentlemen with us today. He is popularly known as AKG. Let's go back to the very, very beginning of hip-hop. You are one of the few people I can talk to who has spanned a period before records, even preceding Brother Herc. And if I'm not mistaken, what we're going to do, we're going to let you explain exactly how the chronology of the early days of hip-hop went as far as your involvement and with the Brother Kool Herc, because I understand that you knew him and worked with him. So why don't you start and tell us how you began, where you were born at, and give us a flavor of what was going on by the time you got old enough to get into this culture that we call it.
Hey, well, yes. Well, I started in hip-hop in 1971. And, you know, I was introduced to it by a guy named DJ Smokey and the Master Plan Bunch. And,
Bronx,
New York.
Gotcha.
And at this particular time, I was about 12 years old. And, you know, I didn't know what this stuff they were doing. You know, at the time, I saw it, and it was called jamming. And it wasn't hip-hop at the time. It was just called jamming. And, you know, when I went to see them several times on the block on 169th and Grant, and I saw people that I didn't know who anybody was at the time because I was just a young kid myself. Mm-hmm. And they were a little older than me. They were like teenagers. They were like, you know, 18, 19, and maybe even close to 20.
What year are we talking and right here? What year are we talking?
We're talking 1971.
Yes.
And, you know, so I saw these guys. I saw Lev Buck Starsky, God bless his soul. I saw him behind the turntables. I saw DJ Lucky, DJ Smokey, and the guy that we know as Grandmaster Flash today, I saw him behind the turntables as well, passing records to Smokey.
In 71.
Yeah, this is 71. I never saw him on the turntable, only saw him passing records.
Gotcha.
And every time I would go, I would never see him on the turntables, just passing records to Smokey.
Okay.
And,
he must have been very young at the time. Last was 71, he must have been very young.
Yeah, so I caught that bug when I was 12 years old and, you know, and been doing it ever since.
Okay. So now, during this period in the Bronx, you have what's called a par chance. Now, I've interviewed Raheem and Kenfield, a few other people, the Park Jams, were they jumping off in 71, 72, or was this a phenomenon that began a few years later, in 73, 74? Give us a chronology on basically how that evolved.
Okay, well, like I said earlier, when I saw the Master Plan bus, they was on a block. They had roped off the block with garbage cans, and they had blocked the street, so they were like doing a block party. Later on, about 73, 74, they started to do, like, you know, parks and things like that.
Oh.
So, the park, proper park.
Right. So, but earlier, they didn't have the big systems in 71, 72 that came to predominate a few years later. Am I correct?
Right. The systems were, the first system I saw was the Master Plan bench system, which they had column speakers, they had Kenwood turntables, and they had mixers, they just had knobs. And
right.
These were the first times I seen put quarters on the needles to hold the needle down. These guys were I saw that put cut cardboard off the record to put the records on so you can backspin on Kenwood turntables because it was belt driven. And these were the first guys that I've seen do that and what have you. And pretty much the whole Technique turntable was built on their technology and their ideals.
Right. Right, I remember the belt driven turntable. You had to be very careful with them.
There only one way, and that was forward.
Okay, so we're in the period now before records, and Bronx is predominant from what I understand from this period, let's say 71 to up to 76. But I got to ask everybody from the Bronx, is this, were there Harlem players in the game also? Harlem and the Bronx, and so sometimes some of the interviews, we all came to realization, I think, that some people back in the day, because there was no internet, if you grew up in the Bronx, you didn't exactly know what was going on in Brooklyn at the same time. You see what I'm saying? Until maybe some years later. And the same thing applied to Harlem. But I grew up in Harlem, and historically,
right.
Harlem and the Bronx, it was always close. Brooklyn was always doing a different dance when you went over there, so they knew you wasn't from Brooklyn. But back in the day, so what was the flavor like in Harlem? I don't know if you traveled back and forth, if your experience was only the Bronx, or if you met people that came up from Harlem. Was Harlem involved during the early period as much as you know?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is I was an interesting kid because at 12 years old, I was 5'11", so I was pretty big for a 12-year-old.
Right.
And you know, I traveled a lot, you know, because back in those days, it was, you know, we had our games and all that stuff too, but it was a more safe environment than it is today.
Right.
So at 12, I traveled. I traveled to Harlem, I traveled to Queens and Brooklyn, and I was in some of the most toughest places because I grew up in the South Bronx in some of the toughest places, so it just seemed fun to me no matter what borough I went to. And so I used to be in Harlem, and in 71, I don't think no one was doing what we call hip-hop today, but by 72, there were certain groups like, you know, Johnny Wawa and Ray Vaughn and the Mean Machine, you know. There were groups coming up from Harlem, and then, you know, in Queens and Brooklyn you had the Infinity Machine. They had a nice system. They were more like disco DJs, but they were like amazing systems. So they go all over the place, and then, you know, Brooklyn and
what about Grandmaster Flowers in Brooklyn?
Yeah, Grandmaster Flowers, yeah, King Charles, you know. So I actually got to know these people a little bit. I was just a young kid, you know, a snotty-nosed kid probably, but, you know, to them. But I meet them, and I was at awe at their systems because they had big birthers and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't know what birthers were until I got to meet some of these guys. And they had a good system. They wasn't like scratching and doing all that stuff. They were just, you know, they were right. mixers. They knew how to blend music together really well. They were super good at that. And they had great systems. The first thing I had from Smokey, Smokey was doing something different. He was scratching on records. He was, you know, and it's interesting.
What borough was he from?
He's from the Bronx. So, and that's how I got the bug on hip hop in 1971. So he was doing something completely different than everybody else. And, you know, and it was just amazing. And then, you know, when I became dominant in the game, I wondered what happened to him. And then I was actually looking for him for about 30 years. And, we finding them all, and we wound up shooting a documentary of their life story, which is called The Dead Souls of Hip Hop, which is coming out soon. I directed it, I shot it, and I wrote it, and did all the editing and everything, and it's a great doc, and it tells their whole life story. I'm also in the doc because their life story is part of my legacy because that's how I started. But they tell a grand story. I mean, they just tell it like it is, and I just let them just tell their story. They've been holding on to it for 50 years.
Wow. And that's one of the persons that you very rarely hear their name mentioned. You hear Disco Mario, you hear AJ, the DJ, DJ Jones, you hear about some of the brothers that, you know what I'm saying? I very rarely hear about DJ Smokey. You're one of the few people in this documentary that concerns and fills a gap in about this brother's life and his influence, early influence of hip hop.
Well, see, some of the people that are legends like myself now, they know about, they're like a myth. They're like Bigfoot or something like that to them,
right?
Because they hear about him, but they never see him.
Right.
And when sometime I have one or two of them with me, and I introduce them to certain people, and they go, "Wow, they do exist," you know, because you know they've heard about them all through their careers, but never got to really see them because they just, you know, wasn't around, you know, and seeing them when I was 12 years old because I lived around the corner from them. I lived on 70th and Morris Avenue, and they were on 169th and Grant Avenue. So I was around the corner, so I had the privilege of seeing this stuff at an early age.
Okay. All right. Now let's get into, move up a few years to 75, 76. And now you've got Park Jams going full blast. You still have no records yet. But you've got the rise of the DJs that we're talking about. Now Flash has his own thing going on. What was it that you began doing in that particular era? We're going a few years before the first recording. I'd like to get into when the Park Jams were full-blown, the Spades and Casanovas were given protection. How did that crew system evolve from what the days you're talking about from 71 and it just had the simple black parties into the Park Jams and it all congealed together with the Spades and Casanovas and everybody having a role to play? And what role were you playing about that time?
Well, to be honest, from 71 to about 77, I was a break dancer.
Okay. Okay. B-boy.
From 71 to 77, and I started rapping in 74. I was 73. I started rapping because I started to get popular around 73. But it was always about the DJ graffiti and breakdancing. That's what hip hop was in the early 70s.
Right.
And so I was a breakdancer, you know, even though I started rapping about 74, 73, I started to dive into the rap stuff, but I didn't take rap serious till about 77.
Okay.
You know, so I was a breakdancer, man. I just went around battling people, man, you know. I remember one time I went south to my family's house, and then I went to some other family members in Riverhead, Long Island, and they took me to the bar, and they played, somebody put on Dance to the Drummer's Beat, and I started breakdancing, and all the people in the bar just stopped doing whatever they was doing. They were just looking at me. They were like, this kid is crazy. What's wrong with your cousin? Because the beat just took control of me, and I started breakdancing, and they never seen this before. And to this day, you know, my cousin said, well, my cousin was doing that way back in the days. Everybody's getting on it now. He was doing that way back in the days. He thought something was wrong with him.
Okay. So you got your big crews now jumping off. You got big sound systems, 76, 77, and you got the emergence of groups. Can you tell us about that particular period? This is just before the first contracts when groups sort of predominated. Did you get a chance to work with any of these cats before you started doing your own thing?
I heard you, man.
Mario. Were you a Black Panther? I'm sorry. Let me go back with the request, because most of the brothers I'm talking from the Bronx were involved. Did you have any gang involvement yourself or association?
No, actually, I come from a real strict Christian background family, and father's
They would tap that behind if you got out of line. One of those
things. I told you one incident, and this is how serious it was.
Sure.
One time, my friend, and he spray painted a man called. He ran, and the man saw me, and he went two houses down from my house, came and told my mother, and it was the beginning of the summer.
Ooh.
My mom punishment for the whole entire summer. I couldn't come outside for the whole entire summer.
Wow. She didn't break down one time and say,
oh, don't get
outside.
Whole entire summer, all I could do was look out the window. All I could do was take the garbage outside.
Michael, I need you to talk louder. I need you to put that microphone close to your phone, maybe your face.
Okay. All right.
So, okay. Would have to, look outside the window and watch kids play, right? And I think she let me out one day before school started.
Man.
And I'll tell you something. I haven't been in any trouble since then. I don't follow people. I don't do stuff. So that was a really important lesson. But, so I didn't get in any gangs or anything like that because
right.
I grew up the way that I grew up. You need to be a part of the gang to be tough.
Right.
And I had good street role models that taught me the good things and the bad things, but I really gravitated more toward the good things. And I knew I didn't need, because I was already a tough kid. I played over headbands and all kind of foolishness when I was a young kid, because I grew up in the South Bronx, you know, bandit building, all that stuff, you know, jumping from building. And I did all the crazy stuff that I sit down today and I go, I did that, and I was crazy. Because, you know, tripped and fell, and I would have been at the end of it, you know? But, I didn't need gangs, you know. I think when people be a part of gangs is because, you know, they need that they need somebody to validate or they need that strength. I was just a strong kid by myself. When I walked into a room, I was a gang by myself.
Beautiful. Okay.
KKG on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop and R&B. Let's move on into the end of your breakdancing phase. At what point did you decide after around 77 that you wanted to do more than be a B-boy?
Well, first of all, I started getting older, and girls weren't really that much into breakdancing. As getting older, the girls that I was interested in guys that was rapping or singing or stuff like that, or driving, have a car, whatever. So I said, well, all right, maybe I need to just step it up and do this rap stuff to give this thing a shot. But, and I did the first rap convention in the Bronx in the PNL, and I didn't win the contest, but you know, a Puerto Rican DJ named Charlie Chase saw me, and he said, hey, you know, I'm not just over at my house, and you know, for this new group I have, the Cold Crush, you know, and you know, why don't you come over? And so I came in and auditioned, and I brought two other MCs with me, Dynamite T and another guy, and we there and auditioned, and he liked me and he picked me, and the rest is history, and I became one of the Cold Crush brothers, and we did our thing from there to still now.
Wow. Okay. The Cold Crush brothers, legendary in New York and worldwide. Can you go into elaborate exactly what happened when you guys formed Cold Crush? Were there any other rap groups around at that time?
There was tons of them. It was really a rap.
Okay, this is 78, but this is just before Records, the first recording contracts, right? That you guys formed your group, right?
Right.
Okay.
So anyway, there were thousands of rap groups back then, just as much as there today. And, you know, everybody was striving to be number one, you know.
Right.
Every team and everybody was striving to be number one, you know. So you had the Funky Four plus one more. You had the Furious Five. You had the Fantastic Five. You know, you had Bam Bada and the Soul Sonic Force, you know.
Okay.
So anyway,
right.
you had the Force MDs, you know, became the Force MCs. Then they became the Force MDs.
Right.
And there's a lot of people out there, you know, from different boroughs, from Jersey, you know, at this point, you know, rap has spread pretty wide, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you're all over the place, you know? You have groups all over the place.
Well, let me ask you this then. Because you weren't affiliated with gangs, most of the other brothers, again, from the Bronx that I interviewed, they had protection. They had protection when they got to the venue and when they got off the stage. Now, your crew, how did you guys roll? Did you have your own protection, or again, did there were certain people that nobody even just messed with? Or how did you circumvent the stick up man?
Well, we had our own security. We had the Cold Crush Brothers security. Tony Crush brother was our security. Another guy named Money Ray, God bless his soul, he was our security. So we had a security crew, but I come from, you know, a family of tough brothers. You know, I had a big brother, and he was tough, and everybody knew him. He had a rep on the street, and nobody ever really messed with me because of that, I believe, most of it. And then, you know, as I grew up, you know, nobody kind of like, you know, messed with me either because I had that.
The way you carry yourself.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, I didn't take tea for the fever.
Okay. Well, let's get into the Wild Style era. Cold Crush Brothers. Now, movies and movie makers during that period became fascinated with this new movement. We had to call it a movement because it's still, I don't think it was still called, it wasn't called hip-hop yet. So how did that come about?
Well, at this particular time, Wild Style, when the Wild Style was created, we had the term hip-hop was coined by Love Bill Skarsky and Keith Cowboy from the Furious Five.
So it did exist at that time. The term did exist by the time Wildstyle came about.
There's a guy named Fat Fox Freddy, and he used to bring Blondie to some of the hip hop shows, and Debbie Harrison, and then he wound up hooking up with some other guys that were filmmakers, and they said, well, we should do a film, you know, and they put the deal together. They brought it to certain people. They brought it to my group, the Fantastic Five. They brought it to Grandmaster Flash. They brought it to a few people. And we wind up doing this movie, which is probably one of the most famous movies ever done because it has the actual people that was around doing it at the time in the movie.
Classic.
So you know, this is not like a Beach Street or anything like that. This is as real as it can get at that particular time.
Right.
So yeah, it was interesting doing that movie. It was fun. I mean, you know, I was about 16 or 17 when I did that movie. And then from that movie, we wound up going to Japan and be the first rap group to tour Japan.
Wow.
And
when
we got to Japan, it all looked like a karate picture to us because they were still wearing the clothes that you would see in a karate movie. And they didn't wear their hat backwards. They didn't wear jeans. They didn't wear sneakers. They didn't wear none of that stuff. So when we went there, it was like we were in a karate picture, you know?
Now, how was it accepted over there, though? How was hip-hop accepted at that time?
When we got there, thousands of people at the airport agreed to say, like how the Beatles invaded America.
Mm-hmm.
It was like that. And it was great. We had a fantastic time. We went to Tokyo, Osaka, and Kyoto. And we had a great time. It really introduced Japanese people to hip-hop. And, you know, right now, hip-hop is very huge there.
Yeah, yes it is. Okay. Who are some of the members of the Cold Crush Brothers?
Well, you have myself, which is AKG. Then you have Grandmaster Caz. Mm-hmm. Then you have CAD. You have JDL. And you have Tony Crush. And then you have Charlie Chase. The six of us.
Okay, the six of you guys. Now, you're like the Dell of hip-hop. And I say that because, you know, the Dells never broke up. I mean, they stayed together, one of the longest groups in R&B to stay together, probably besides the Isaacs. Now, you guys still perform. I know individually you do stuff, but do you still perform as a Cold Crush unit?
Yes, we do. Lately, we have a show coming up in August, August 9th, in the amphitheater down in the Lower East Side in Manhattan. We're doing the Wild Style Reunion on August 9th. You come out and you sit out there in the amphitheater and you watch all these groups. You probably see Busy Bee Starsky. Well, all the people that are going to watch that is going to pretty much be on the show.
Okay. Now, before we leave the Cold Crush Brothers, I need to ask you. Records start coming out. People start giving out contracts. How did that change the game from when everybody was just doing it, park jams and having fun and doing this thing we call hip-hop for fun? How did the awarding of recording contracts change the game? And where were the Cold Crush Brothers during this era? Were you interested in the recording contracts? Or you let us tell us what transpired, how the game was changed during the era when records started being recorded?
Well, in the early days, before I got with the Cold Crush, I used to always say, wow, it would be great if we could do what we do on records. Because when I first heard the third, I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. But it's not what we do, but pretty cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, I said, well, if we can get our stuff on the radio like this, on the records, it would be really cool. Mm-hmm. And you know, people started to work with Bobby Robinson, God bless her soul, and Sylvia Robinson, God bless her soul. So, you know, and then we didn't sign with a lot of labels because a lot of labels wanted to control us, and we felt that we just didn't want to be controlled. So we kind of, you know, didn't engage as fast as other groups did. And thus, you know, not going on big major tours and things like that. We are like, my group, we're considered like the Grateful Dead or something like that, you know. We just like doing what we do, and people just come to see us do what we do because we just do something that's very extraordinary and no one else can do it, you know. It's like looking at James Brown or something like that. No one can do what he does. He's a special item, you know.
Yes, sir.
Now, so, yeah, and on top of that, you know, I just put out a new CD, EP called Brand New Day, and
it's a solo project?
Yes, yeah, a solo project. It's an AKG, and CD is very important to me because in the last 3 years, I was dealing with a lot of health issues.
Mm.
So after I've pretty much healed myself from heart disease and high blood pressure, I put together this CD. And, you know, I tell people all the time now that I'm much older, much wiser, and much stronger, that I don't rap about what I see. I rap about what I want people to be.
Wow. And I think my producer has got a track for you. The EP is called A Brand New Day or A New Day?
Brand New Day.
A Brand New Day. And what is the track that we're going to hear?
I don't know. Y'all could just speak. I would say Brand New Day because Brand New Day is what it is for me, you know. When you're dealing with heart disease and 2 or 5 surgeries, you know, I'm stronger than most, but, you know, to bounce back from that, it's a brand new day.
We're going to talk about it.
Yeah, a brand new day. It's a new day. Don't let nobody hold you down.
A brand new day.
You know how we do it. Let's go. Yeah. It's a new day. Don't let nobody hold you down. Yeah. You know how we do it. Let's go.
Get your pants up off the ground. You can do anything if you can see it now. The enemy is trying to hold you down. But don't forget that God holds the crown. You can be the next president to change the world from acid to alkaline and change the mind of the young and the old. So once again, we can all be whole.
Yeah, it's a new day. Don't let nobody hold you down. Yeah, you know how we do it. Let's go.
Remember back when you was young, you played outside, you had so much fun. Those summer nights was the bomb. Nobody got killed, no cop alarm. We gotta take back our community. We gotta bring back that unity. So we don't have to bury our young. Let's take a stand, every woman and man.
Yeah, it's a new day.
The world is yours, it needs to heal. We gotta start doing what's right, not just what we feel. We gotta take care of earth, they give us life. The wind, the water, the air, that's right. We gotta do it for the next generation. All God creation, cause this is our home. Let's treat it as such, and every human being give it a loving touch.
Yeah, it's a new day. Don't let nobody hold.
witness to bullying. You can change the game if you're willing. Bullying is not cool at all. We gotta respect one another. That's the call. You see bullying happening, tell someone. Because being bullying definitely ain't fun. Let's all step up and deal with this threat. And tell all the rest, stop bullying me.
Yeah,
a brand new day.
It's a new day.
Don't let nobody hold you down.
A brand new day.
Yeah. You know how we do it.
Wow, that is dope. That is so dope. AKJ, brand new day on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop and R&B. You're hearing it first. Now, you've been in the studio with this EP. Has it been released yet?
Yes, it's released. You can find it on Amazon, iTunes, anywhere you can buy a CD online, you can find it. And Amazon is the only delivery that allows you to have a physical CD or a download.
Okay. All right. We're going to talk more about the music. But I understand that you would like to talk to some of the brothers out there. In fact, men in general, who we're so macho, we don't really take care of ourselves during our younger years. We think we're going to live forever. And you've got a message to talk about as far as health issues concerning us. Mr. AKG, why don't you let us know your feelings on this subject?
Well, you know, the bottom line is you have to take care of yourself. You have to eat right. See, when I developed heart disease, I went in and I studied the human anatomy. Now,
I want to interrupt you. How old were you? Because heart disease, we usually think of hitting older people, 60, 70. How old were you when you had your first experience?
I was about 51 when it started.
Okay.
And I you know, when I had this problem, I didn't know what was going on with me. And
What kind of symptoms were you getting?
Well, the symptoms you get out of breath, it feel like, you know, your lungs is gonna collapse on you because you feel like an elephant is sitting on your chest.
Wow.
And I had it so bad that I couldn't walk from the couch to the kitchen table without being out of breath.
Wow. My breath of blessings.
This is what most people go through when they have heart problems. And so when I got to hospital, I started to study the human anatomy. And what I found was pretty interesting that, you know, all humans, we all think we are alike, but we're different, especially black humans. We have what's called carbon in our body, and the doctors call it melanin, but there's really no such word as melanin. It's carbon, and carbon exists in every green plant on the earth.
Right.
We have that in our body. So if we don't get fresh water and sunlight, we're going to be very sick and we're going to die, just like a plant. If you don't get plant fresh water and sunlight, it'll die. And we're like that. You know, once I understood that, I started drinking good water, fresh water, pH balanced water. And I stopped drinking tap water. I don't cook with tap water. I don't drink with tap water. I don't brush my teeth with tap water. And when I take a shower, I have a 10-filter shower, filter on my shower. So when the water runs through it, it runs through 10 filters before it touches my body. Because what people are aware of is that when, as you grow up, you think you only drink from your mouth, but you drink from your whole entire body. Your whole entire body is a mouth. And you're not educated to know this because people actually want to take care of you. So when you take a shower, you actually drink about 12 cups of water every time you take a shower and a bath. So if you do, like most people do, take two showers a day, you're drinking a lot of water. And if that water is contaminated, it's going all over your body. And it's seeping in your toes, every part of your body, your head, everything, when you wash your hair, everything. So I became aware of that. I changed a few things. I've changed, and there's no such thing as a diet. It has to be a lifestyle change. Diets don't exist. That's to make you think you're doing something. It's almost like democracy, you know? Give people democracy to make them feel like they're part of something. But you don't call no shots. You don't sit on the panel that controls what happens.
Right.
So give people democracy, because most people say, you know, humans are like a hand on a clock, around and around and around they go. So once I started myself and understood all this stuff, I was able to heal myself and basically just, you know, eating fresh vegetables and fruit, organic, without any pesticides on it, because, you know, most humans eat about 2 to 3 pounds of pesticides a year.
Right.
Okay. And this is why, you know, and then, you know, they tell you that you can get protein and stuff from the meat, but I pushed away the middleman, and I just get protein from plants and vegetables.
And you're doing much better now, my brother?
Oh, yeah. I went from, my heart was beating under 20% about 2.5 years ago to now about 85-90% now.
Wow. So it is reversible to a certain extent if you can catch yourself and discipline yourself. Like you did research also on your body. Okay, so is there any way that you disseminate any of this information now? You got a web page, or do you give speeches on this, or do you just take these opportunities like this radio interview to do that?
I push it like that, but I am available for lectures and to come talk to the youth and different things like that, because I think, you know, people need to see something that's physical, something that they can touch, and say, you know, wow, you know, I'm going through that right now. You know, there's a lot of people probably listening right now that's going through it, you know. And I would tell them the first thing you might want to do is to grab you some black seed oil and take that.
Now, do you know that's how many times I've heard that the past maybe year, even my producer,
I know she's listening. Yeah. Yeah. It works for you.
It works for you.
You know, because black seed oil heals, and that's for everybody. I'm not getting any money from the black seed oil company. I'm just putting the message out there and let you know experience. The black seed oil helps with 101 thing in the human body. And been around since. They've been around since Kemet. Most people don't know what Kemet is, but that's what they call Egypt, but it was first called Kemet.
Man, my brother is deep. And let's get into that a little bit. You're a deep brother. You're also an inventor. We just heard your regimen for health. It takes a certain amount of intelligence to say to yourself, let me do my research and see what I can do. Because you're the only person who can change things about you as far as health and your diet, well, not diet, but, you know, the things you eat, your activities and things like that. But you're an inventor.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You're on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop and R&B as an inventor. Tell us a little bit about that, how you got involved. I was a science kid. I think I told you I became a DJ while I was in school for radio engineering. And I dropped all of that, but I love the atoms and molecules and stuff. Tell us how you, basically that side of AKG. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, for me, it started with my brother, because my brother, he used to break my toys.
He's older than you.
He used to break my toys. I used to have robots. He'd break them and see how they work and all that. And then 30 years, I picked up his little knack of wanting to, like, learn about stuff and how it works and things like that. So, and then as the years progressed, I became a thinker. I like to tinker with things. And I like to, you know, and I sit back and I watch humans and I watch what they like or what they would need in the future.
Right.
So I invent stuff. I invent things that you're going to need like 20, maybe sometime 30 years from now.
Have you gotten actual patents for some of this stuff?
I have 16 patents on all my inventions because when I invent them, I go in and lock the windows.
Wow, you're a serious inventor, my brother. What is the process? I mean, you can't explain the creative process, but once you come up with an idea, who do you reach out to and say, because you got to have prototypes and stuff like that. Tell us about how that process works once you've conceived of an idea.
Well, once you get an idea, you are in the creative process, and something is going to manifest from that. So you start taking in the stuff, and then obviously you want to get with someone who can or a company that can help you move your invention along. You have to be careful because people do steal ideas.
Of course.
So you have to be careful, and you have to get with the right companies to help you achieve that, or hire a patent attorney to help you get this done. You know, I've learned how to do my own patents, but it's really hard because when I first started doing it, it was like my brain was starting to ooze out of my ears.
Wow.
That hard to do. So to explain it would just be like, I'd be just sounding generous explaining it really down to details. But I think if you want to get it done and you have a great idea, you should go and seek a patent and a design attorney. Because you have to also patent not just the ideal, but you also have to patent the design.
Right. Okay.
So it's a lot that goes into that. So, you know, and I know a lot of people have great ideals and they just, you know, never do anything with them.
Right.
Please don't do, you know, because I wish I came up with the paper plate and the plastic fork.
The safety.
But I was sitting on some beach right now going, can you believe we made all this money on
yeah.
And paper and plastic forks. Can you believe that?
Man, you're a man of many disciplines, my brother. You're a man of many disciplines. Let's get into, now you're into production. You have some television productions, I believe, that you're working on some ideas coming up. You want to talk a little bit about that?
I'm in the process of selling one of my TV shows. I have about 12 TV shows I've written, and I'm in the process of selling one of them. Not all my TV shows are based on black culture. You know, I have some, like, Archie Bunker type TV shows where ain't no black people. So, you know, and sometimes, you know, people are going to see me go up there, and I'm going to be standing next to, like, Woody Allen or something like that, and, you know, for one of my shows. And it's like, it ain't got to do with no black culture. It's just a show. So I have, like, a lot of things that I write, because when I write, I don't put myself in a box or anything like that. So when I'm creating stuff, I just stay in the creative mind, and I just go with it, you know, because I've been privileged in the time that I've been here on Earth to see different cultures and to get to know different cultures. So I learn about different things, you know, try to just make the world a better place than what I was born in. And,
yes,
you know,
sir.
And that's the whole idea about it, you know. So I have a lot of different things I'm doing, and people be on the lookout, you know. You'll hear more as I go in, you know. A lot of stuff, I can't talk too much about it because I have, like,
right.
you know, disagreement with these people. So, but I will tell you this, in a minute you're going to see me on a lot of different stuff, doing a lot of TV stuff and whatnot, because I self-trained myself to do animation, which was the first thing I got involved in, which was really hard. Animation is like, doing algebra versus regular math. And
could you draw? I mean, were you a basic artist before you even got into the electronic part of it? Could you always draw?
Well, I used to draw, but I really got into the more technical part of animation, how to make the characters come to life. But, I'll get someone to do the drawing because I'm not that good of a drawer, but putting it in the art machine and making it work and making it walk and talk and move.
I got you. Okay.
You know,
all
right. That type, like when you see like the Incredibles and stuff like that, I do animation like that.
Wow. Okay.
So when I got to film was like, you know, like second grade math to me, you know what I'm saying? Because it's so easy compared to animation. You know, animation is just part with all the rendering and all that. It's just real tedious.
Okay, you are a multifaceted brother, AKG. Now let's talk a little bit about hip hop, about today's hip hop. You're one of the few people that I can talk to who comes from a day before it was called hip hop. And it's still alive now to see what this worldwide culture has become. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I always thought it would be something big. But I never thought it would be a $1 trillion business. No, I remember when I was young and I went to CBS before they became Sony Music. And there was some Italians and some Jews up in there. And I got something that to make money and to sell, it was called hip hop. And they pretty much laughed me out the office. They said,
I'm sure they did.
I took it, you know, 16 year old kid, you know. And they said, well, come back when you got some disco or rock. And they just laughed me out. They said, that's a fad. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I left the office with my head down. And I think if those old guys are around today, they're not laughing now.
Yes, sir. And what do you think of today's various forms of hip-hop, trap, mumble rap, all of this kind of stuff?
Well, you know, I think I like the way it's still progressing, and that is the popular music of our time. Now, just like anything else in life, you know, you got a lot of people that don't want a Mercedes-Benz or don't want a Jaguar. Some people just like their horse and carriage. Myself, I like some stuff, and I don't like some stuff, just like anyone would. You know? So I think it's doing good as far as keep moving forward. You know, I personally would like to see more conscious hip hop, you know, because I think, you know, we influence a lot of people. A lot of times people don't want to be role models, but when you're put in the atmosphere, that's what you are. And, you know, and when you become a celebrity star, you're a star. And you know what a star does? A star shines. Because come out every night if you look up in the sky and they don't come out for themselves, they just shine. And if you're a star, you need to act like you're a star and do what's right because it's an opportunity that many don't have. And you put on a platform to help many people. You know, and you're not going to be their father or their mother, you know, or their preacher. You don't have to know that. What you do have to be is someone who guides them in the right direction so they can be prosperous in life. Now, once again, that takes maturity. So sometimes you got to give them time to grow, too. And then they'll get there. And if God bless them to be around and have a long career like mine, they will get there. But, you know, when they fall, you got to let them be young, too, you know?
There you go, my brother. The proof is in the pudding. You are still here. You're still relevant. Yes, you're still producing.
Yes, sir.
You're still creating. Okay, Mr. AKG from Cold Crush Brothers. Now, I want to thank you for your contribution to hip-hop. I want to thank you for your contribution to music in general. Okay, you're still contributing. You're contributing to society in the form of information you've just given us about health, which is very important in this day and time. A lot of our brothers are leaving here in their 50s. Some in their 40s, my brother. You know what I'm saying? Behind neglected health issues. So it's very important. You know, you represent what I consider to be the epitome of a person who's lived a long life and still has a lot more to go. Okay?
Yeah.
Mr. AKG?
So wasn't it a great show? Come back next week, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Central Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop Show. Man, it's a great one. Epic, epic. See you next week. Bye.